Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. More than a year and a half into the active phase of the Ukrainian conflict, it is still being portrayed by Western media as an unprovoked, heinous, and indiscriminate attack by Russia against its free-spirited, brave, and dexterous neighbor, which by Hollywood logic should prevail sooner or later, thanks to the high morale of its troops and the generous support of its allies. Is this scenario, as evocative as it may be, passing the reality check? Well, to discuss it, I'm now joined by Larry Johnson, former analyst with the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency and CEO of Burke Associates. Mr. Johnson, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Oksana.
You've written before that what Russia is pursuing in Ukraine should not be termed as a war, that because Russia didn't go all in, it's using its forces and resources in a pretty limited and I think still selective fashion. But people watching us would ask, why should we care about how we term it? Because people are dying anyway. Why engage in this linguistic nitpicking?
Well, because the amount of people that are dying, well, I'm talking civilians, is would be drastically higher if this was an actual war. If you're looking at an actual war, what we're talking about, Russia would be taking out all intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance assets that are in the air in or around Russia and Ukraine. They're not doing that. They would take out and attack satellites. They're not doing that. They would be destroying every government building in Kiev that was in any way involved with assisting the war. They haven't done that. So there are a lot of things that Russia has not done. And I think part of it is, one, to avoid killing civilians unnecessarily. That's, you know, quite a contrast to the past conduct of countries like my own, the United States and Great Britain during World War II, where there was indiscriminate bombing of civilian areas without regard to the civilian casualties. So I think the linguistics does matter.
Now, Mr. Johnson, many Americans or people from the West like to sort of refer us to history a long way back. But what strikes me about this whole discourse in the West is that somehow it seems that the very notion of a nation using its military force to defend its strategic interests has been outlawed. It's considered illegitimate, whereas the West is in actuality the largest military bloc. And it has to be said that it hasn't been shy of using force in foreign countries in recent decades, not just in World War II,
right,
but in recent
right.
decades. And I think when we look at the conduct of American war in Afghanistan or in Iraq, it cannot be described as particularly discriminate. Why do you think so many people are shocked that Russia would use its military force to defend what it repeatedly described, publicly described as a threat?
The major part of the problem is, let's call it the parochial nature of the United States. The vast majority of the U.S. citizens are not well-read. They pay very little attention to foreign policy. They'd have trouble locating Ukraine on a map. And as a result, they've been very susceptible to a steady stream of propaganda that has painted Russia as this aggressive imperial power. You'll hear many Americans talk about the imperial ambitions of Russia, completely clueless about the reality that since 1990, the only country in the world that has carried out expeditionary military operations in more than six other countries is the United States, not Russia. When you try to point out to people the fact that if the United States was facing Chinese military activity in Mexico or Russian military activity in Mexico or in Canada, the United States would take action. We would view that as a direct threat to us. Yet when the United States does the same thing to Russia, over the last, since 2014, they've carried out over 8 military exercises with NATO and U.S. troops in Ukraine that Russia could only interpret as a preparation to attack Russia. And yet, in the United States, we don't see that at all as provocative or as causing the Russians to react.
Now, is it them being clueless, or is it them assuming that, you know, the United States too has the right to do whatever it wants because it's on the right side of history, and Russia simply, for whatever reason, cannot use the resources at its disposal to defend its own?
I think what we're looking at is cluelessness, and then the people that have been overwhelmed with propaganda. Since, you know, whenever the United States has faced an opportunity to get engaged overseas, they've taken advantage of it and always painted it in terms of we're fighting them there so we don't have to fight them here, that this is in the pursuit of freedom. So, the United States invaded Iraq twice and didn't leave that country any more free or prosperous. Ditto, same thing for Afghanistan. We're currently engaged in Syria with absolutely no legal justification. And yet the vast majority of Americans aren't even aware of that kind of involvement. So it's really a function of the lack of education in this country and the control of information, which has become really, unlike you, I'm old enough to remember the days of the Cold War during the 70s and 80s. When we saw on the Soviet side a control of information and a failure to tell the truth about a lot of things. Well, now we've seen the roles reversed. The United States is operating very much like the old days of Pravda and TASS under the Soviets.
You pointed out in other interviews that victory in an armed conflict depends not only on whether you happen to find yourself on the U.S. assigned good or right side of history, but also on pretty practical factors, manpower and your access to weapons, as well as the ability of your men to operate all those weapons. And when we look at these hard data, it's pretty clear that there's a huge gap between what Ukraine has and what Russia has and what Russia may have, you know, a couple of years or months down the line. Now, I can understand that this is not an interesting subject for lay public, but I cannot believe that American generals or NATO generals would not know this, would not know about this gap. Why are they, you know, sort of going along with the story that the high morale of the great Ukrainian soldiers will ultimately deliver the victory?
Now, that's been one of the most remarkable and disturbing developments in the course of this, the last 18 months since the start of the military operation in Ukraine. The number of retired generals, and we're talking people with three and four stars, which meant that they were at the top of the military pyramid. People like David Petraeus, Ben Hodges, who was the commander of in Europe, the European command. Others like Stanley McChrystal and Jack Keane. You know, you go down the list. They all keep failing to acknowledge the logistics reality of what's taking place in this war. That, for example, they all have said that we need to look at the parallels of the United States invading Iraq, and that was our ability to overcome the Saddam's army was made possible because we had air supremacy. And then in the next breath, they talk about Ukraine being able to break through Russian defensive lines, and yet acknowledging Ukraine does not have anything approaching air supremacy. They are on the opposite end of that spectrum. They have no air force that can effectively challenge or attack Russian lines. It is Russia that has air supremacy. Now,
Mr. Joseph, can I slightly interject here and ask you, what do you see as the main reason? Because again, the American public can be clueless. You cannot blame them for that. But military or war fighting is a profession. I mean, these people are being taught for decades. They have, decades of experience. They are supposed to know this stuff. Why do you think they're going along with this fantasy thinking? Because as you said before, I mean, they participated in other campaigns. They know that it's not just about what you imagine. It's actually happening on the ground.
Well, part of it is the kind of people that have been selected for command. The process is, it's a bureaucratic process where those who don't ask critical questions, those who do not engage with critical thinking, don't get promoted. The people that get promoted are the folks that are saying, hey, boss, that's a great idea. Or they do the staff work and provide these gentlemen with choices. And all they have to do is say, I'm going to take A, B, or C, like choosing what to eat off of a Chinese menu. So when they get to these top positions, very rarely are you dealing with people who have demonstrated great critical thinking skills and independent skills. They don't do their own writing. They don't do their own analysis. They depend upon others for that. So that once they're out of the military, they no longer have that kind of staff to do that work for them. So they're left to on their own devices. And so what we're seeing are basically people who have, lots of experience, but they're not very intelligent. They're not very smart. They don't know how to do critical thinking. I mean, I'm not presenting myself as some genius, but I can figure out that if one side of engaged in a conflict is firing 100 artillery rounds and the other side is firing 1,000 rounds back, that the side that's firing 1,000 rounds has the advantage.
Absolutely. And there is also a human toll to this math, because I mean, the side that is firing only 100 rounds, I mean, is poised to lose many more people. Do you think that all those folks who are glorifying the brave Ukrainian soldiers and the great Ukrainian nation are actually caring about the fact whether the Ukrainian soldiers will live to see another day?
Yeah, no, there's absolutely zero regard for the fate of the Ukrainians. And in fact, to diminish the number of actual casualties and while exaggerating Russia's casualties, again, the target audience for that is just simply to persuade the American people to continue to support what is a lost cause. And the nature of that lost cause has become more apparent. You get people like David Petraeus, this retired general. He also was the head of the CIA. He just said the other day that unlike Russia, the Ukrainians, they're fighting because they look over their shoulders. They look back at their homeland. That's what gives them inspiration. And here, completely clueless about Russia's history and fending off foreign invaders, making this current conflict even more relevant, given the neo-Nazi elements that dominate in Ukraine in the modern era, the resurrection of people like Stefan Bandera. So they're dealing with a genuine Nazi threat, and they don't understand how that resonates among the people of Russia, who still carry the memory of World War II. Most Americans have forgotten about World War II, but that's not the case in Russia because so many Russians died in that conflict.
Absolutely, and thank you for still holding that memory and bringing that history to wider audiences. But for the time being, we have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
The Biden administration and NATO world are fascinated with soft power and rhetorical shifts. Remember, Ukraine will win and Ukraine is winning. Now we hear Russia is losing and even Russia has lost. Narrative manipulations do not change hard reality.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact.
Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Larry Johnson, former analyst with the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency and CEO of Berg Associates. Mr. Johnson, before the break, we were talking about how one wins a war and whether the high morale is enough for weapons or for training your soldiers properly. And you pointed out that the Russians, too, have a deep-spirited interest in, and there are many volunteers who are going to the front lines, but that in itself is not enough. The government has to provide, equipment and training so that people survive. And this is what I want to ask you about, because in the last couple of months, there is a new phrase that entered the Russian vernacular, and I think I would term it as unit or troop cohesion, and this is something that you cannot import. I mean, even if you have the manpower, if you have the weapons, you need to make sure that people can operate together effectively. And it's not just a technical thing; it's a psychological thing as well. Right. And I know that from my interviews with foreign guests that many military professionals in other countries are watching that. They're looking at how this conflict develops and how all that various weaponry that the West is providing can be operated and how successfully it could be operated. What kind of lessons do you think they're drawing at this point?
Well, they're certainly not accurately portraying what is occurring in Russia. They are projecting onto Russia the actual things that are transpiring in Ukraine. For example, they're talking about the poor military leadership that Russia's generals are exercising, that there's poor morale among the Russian troops, that these conscripts that are forced into the Russian military are poorly trained and poorly equipped. Now, none of that is true. And what we know throughout history, regardless of the army, that troops, when they get engaged in combat, they fight for each other. What we've seen from Russia is a methodical development of its troops and providing them adequate training over time. And that training serves two purposes primarily. One, to equip them with the skills they need to have to survive in a combat environment. But two, to build that unit cohesion. As they get to know each other, they get to work together, they work on common tasks, that builds a bond of that then lasts through combat. Well, what you're getting on the Ukraine side is they're dragging people off the street, boys as young as 16, 17 years of age, and men 50 years of age and older. They just had the other day, the Financial Times reported, a 71-year-old guy that had been dragged into to be a tank, running a tank, and he's in training in Germany. I mean, this is unheard of. So, and when the Ukrainians are only getting 4 or 5 weeks of military training at that, not only is it not enough time to acquire the military skill to go into combat, but they don't develop the kind of unit cohesion, which is also a critical factor. And so that's what the West is missing. They continue to paint Russia as a cartoon version of a military without understanding it's a very serious military and quite capable.
Let's talk about this wonder weapon phenomenon, this ever-expanding list of weapons supplied to Ukraine. Can you explain the logic of this ever-increasing nomenclature of weapons without addressing the quantity gap? Because even if you supply, all the tanks from all over the world to Ukraine, that's not going to make Ukrainians more capable if the numbers of those tanks are limited, let alone if they don't know how to operate them.
Yeah, it's Hollywood's fault, I would argue, because in Hollywood, you've got the silver bullet that kills the werewolf, or the garlic that kills Dracula, or Frodo's, you know, the ring of power that's going to control the world. It's, it creates this mentality that there's one kind of magical weapon that can change the entire landscape. And it's just not true. You know, we've seen it over and over and over in the course of this conflict. You know, first it was the arrival of the M777 howitzer with 155 millimeter shells. Boy, that was going to be a game changer. Keep hearing that word. Then the HIMARS. No, no, that's going to be the game changer. And now they're the cluster munitions. Oh, another game changer. The tanks, game changer. F-16s, a future game changer. None of it works. All of these weapon systems depend upon the most important factor, which is having the ability to actually do combined arms and having troops that are trained and properly led to execute those commands. So the weapons, those weapon systems are nice add-ons, and they do provide some capability, but it is not the game changer. And what you really have, as I call it, it's the Hollywood legacy. It has convinced people to believe that there is the magic weapon that can turn things around.
Now, speaking about this Hollywood influence or indoctrination, I would say, I think... Well, at least in my opinion, one of the secondary goals of this military operation is to do away with this American mantra that perception is reality. And I think the Americans and the Westerners, the Ukrainians, are still seem to be convinced that perception trumps everything, whereas the Russians have they don't have many capabilities when it comes to global informational war, but I think their main focus is on creating, shaping, and maintaining the realities on the ground, and the gap between perception and the actual reality is widening. I wonder how long are you going to give it before it will become impossible to sustain, before this narrative that is being fed to global audiences will collapse on itself?
I think we're approaching that end game, because you're correct. You know, we've got historical examples of this where, you know, we saw it in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. The guy called Baghdad Bob kept insisting there are no American tanks in Baghdad. And in the background, you could see the tanks actually rolling down the streets. So the reality ultimately catches up with these lies. What I find so disturbing as an American is the breadth and audacity of the lies that proliferate on the American side. And its primary goal, it does not affect how Russia fights the war. It does, but what it does affect is provides at least some modicum of support among the American people for a lost cause, without stepping back to realize the United States already has spent as much, the total amount of money spent on the war in Iraq, both in military equipment aid, exceeds what Russia would spare on its whole military budget. It's astonishing. And so these lies that are pushing the United States really to bankrupt itself. And I think the first break is going to come in this side of the ocean from an economic crisis. Because once we enter that economic crisis, we'll no longer be able to afford this luxury of just pouring money down the rat hole that is Ukraine.
Now, I heard you say in another interview that this conflict is not going to end until Volodymyr Zelensky is gone, and that in your view, the most likely scenario would be his military generals or military commanders pushing him out. I wonder, though, if the Western elites, too, may have at some point an interest in seeing Zelensky gone.
They may. You know, he has become a bit of an irritant with his constant request for more guns and more ammunition and more money. At the same time that he just, you know, he continues to buy up luxury properties in other countries around the world. Apparently just purchased an estate in Egypt. So, I can see the West becoming quite tired of him, but I do think the real impetus, because the ones who are paying for the cost of his policies, it's not really his policies. He's a puppet in this. You know, he's not the strategic genius. He's a comedian who played a piano with a part of his anatomy. So he's not really a serious strategic thinker, but yet he's been put into that role. And like a good actor, he's been playing that role.
Well, you know, some good strategic thinkers here in Moscow believe that this war is also pretty, pretty good deal for the Americans, because it provides them with an opportunity of undermining their strategic rival on a cheap, because ultimately it's the Ukrainians who are losing their lives, and the Western countries get an opportunity of getting rid of their old rusty weaponry and perhaps order some new, more expensive ones. I wonder, though, if there is anything that you can foresee that may change the calculus among the Western elites and make this war unprofitable for them, for them to see or want to see an end to this conflict.
Well, I think that process has already started. The West made an enormous miscalculation. At the outset of this, they thought, number one, Russia's economy was weak and fragile, that if you impose sanctions, you're going to cause that economy to break, which will put political pressure to get rid of Vladimir Putin. That was number one. Number two, they had invested heavily in the Ukrainian army. Recognized that even though Ukraine was not part of NATO officially, it was a de facto member. And as a de facto, Ukraine's army, as of February 2022, a half ago, Ukraine's army represented the second largest army in NATO, followed by, you know, the United States was number one, Ukraine number two, Turkey number three. So what the West was calculating is that this second most powerful army in NATO would be able to either, if not break Russia, weaken it substantially so that the West would be in a position to take it over. That's completely collapsed. They didn't count on the fact that Russia is self-sufficient in all critical natural resources, has still an intact military-industrial complex. The West no longer has that capability. At the outbreak of World War II, Russia and the United States, or the Soviets and the United States at the time, produced the same number of tanks over from the period of January 1942 to April of 1945. They had the same kind of power. That's no longer the case. The United States has basically hollowed out its ability to be an industrial power.
Militarily, Russia is likely to prevail, but I think that leaves Moscow with a very dangerous terrorist threat, because the Ukrainian nation, understandably so, is very aggrieved. There are many people who have lost everything, many people who are psychologically disturbed. And what happened to Ukraine is a huge tragedy for the Russians, first and foremost. How do you think the Russians should address it? And do you think that's also a problem for the West, the aggrieved Ukrainians who have no future in sight?
Well, that's one of the other things the West is betting on. I've heard several generals comment, well, now ultimately, we'll start an insurgency, a guerrilla warfare, a terrorist warfare against Russia, and that'll weaken Russia. They keep forgetting Russia has already been through this kind of conflict in Chechnya. They faced a serious terrorist threat that killed thousands of Russian civilians. And yet Russia ultimately prevailed in that conflict. And the advantage here is, unlike, you know, the United States battling ISIS terrorists, where the United States has no knowledge of the culture or language and no experience in those particular areas where those groups operate, Russia knows Ukraine. Most of the Ukrainian people speak Russian. So there's not a language difference. There's not a cultural difference. So the ability of Russia to quell any kind of terrorist campaign, I think, is quite robust.
Well, we have to leave it there, but it's been great talking to you. Thank you very much for your expertise and sharing it.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.